He has hard blue eyes and an unpleasant mouth, and a rather hooked nose. He looks strong, but hard and ruthless. He rides on and meets a detachment of troops coming up the valley. They help him to dismount, and put the wounded man on a stretcher. Several officers shake hands with him. The troops advance rapidly. He goes with them. They sweep up the valley. A great cloud of dust blots them out. Can see them again. They are storming the hillside. Boulders are hurtling down the slope. Again the dust blots them out. Once more can see them. They are much higher up. They are storming the crest. The hillsmen are mown down by the rifle fire, and drop like rabbits. Again a great cloud of dust covers the whole picture and blots it from view. Nothing but dust. The bottle of water begins to reappear. That is all. Fourth letter from the officer, written automatically in trance, February 10, 1914, at Mr. K.S. house, 8 p.m., the officer. You must not expect anything very pleasant as yet from me. You want the truth, and you shall have it. It is well that the world should know the truth, and not only the rosy side of it. I told you of the drinking den, and before I go on further I had better describe and explain what the vision you saw means. Gone west, it shows an incident in my early life. I rescued a man under fire when a cowardly skunk ran away. That was I. You hear nothing but bad about me, still, I had a few sparks of better things. Now to proceed with my story. I need not go through all our life here. Just as we went to a pub, we also went to a bad house. The great guide over lust is a spirit like a woman, but foul beyond compare, loathsome in every way. I will not go into details. But, as we could get a Dead Sea fruit satisfaction at the pub, so we can in like manner satisfy almost all our lusts. Satisfy? Did I say? No, just the reverse. That is our punishment, the craving for what we want but cannot really attain. Oh, the hell of it. For all the while we are helping to drag down others. Oh, what fools these mortals are. Do you suppose you can give rein to evil and not suffer and not make others suffer? I think you had better rest for half an hour. Gone West, Chapter 5, A Seance, Letter from the Officer, March 7. After a while I began to find that drink dens bored me a little. Then the dark spirit who acted as my guide said to me, "Shall we go to a seance?" "What for?" I inquired. "Well, much fun can be derived from some of them," he answered. "Nothing else?" I inquired. "Yes, if you are not careful to maintain the supply of semi-material elements which form this body you wear here, you'll find yourself losing it and dropping down to hell." "Am I not in hell now?" "No, you are still on the earth plane. You'd quickly feel the difference if you were in hell, really in hell." "I'll do anything to keep this body going," I cried. "Now explain matters to me. I once went to a séance. I certainly could not account for everything I saw, but put it down to fraud." He replied, "These séances fall into three main divisions, but often there is a good deal of overlapping. 1. Genuine ones where the medium is controlled by a good spirit. 2. Genuine cases where the medium is controlled by evil spirits like ourselves. 3. Fraud. Now, of course, we can't do anything with number 1, and number 3 is useless, but number 2 is different, and often we succeed in leading astray a medium and converting her into number 2. I inquired, "What is it that enables you to get control?" He answered, "If the medium uses her power for her own selfish ends, to advance her own fortunes, etc., then we can get control." "Do you mean that they may not take money?" "Oh no, a medium, just like a parson, has to live. You don't think any the worse of a parson because in time he gets a vicarage with £400 a year. A vicar may become a bishop at £3,000, but he does not cease to be a good priest necessarily by that fact. If, however, a parson, instead of trying to help his fellow men, devotes his whole time to getting on in position and fortune, you would at once say he was not a good priest. So with mediums, it's the motive, and there is no deceiving us in that. Once the motive becomes low, then comes our chance. What good to ourselves do we gain by doing this sort of work?" I asked. He leered. "First, You gain material elements for this psychic body. Then you gain power. Power. Doesn't that word make you think? Isn't it splendid to be able to lead many people by the nose? Above all, and here he leered even more villainously than before, we can pay off old scores, and even occasionally obtain a temporary incarnation. Now, isn't that worth striving for? Again to walk the earth knowing all you have learned here, eh? I seized on the idea, and soon, with a band of other spirits, we congregated in a room where a woman was sitting surrounded by about a dozen men and women. Beside her stood a great spirit of light, the first I had seen, but he was sore beset by a mob of evil spirits. Again and again he hurled us back, but at length one evil spirit obtained control. Then a howl of delight rose from us all, and we rushed round her and began to form a complete ball of spirits round, above, and below her. What are we doing? I asked my evil guide. Gone west. We are insulating her from the influence of her guardian angel. He cannot penetrate this wall of evil, any more than he can penetrate the wall of good which is around the best mediums. Now watch the spirit who has got to work. The medium began to speak. Turning to a middle-aged woman, she said, I am your sister Sally, and proceeded to give several pieces of evidence. How does he know all these facts? I asked. Easy enough, he's hung round this medium for years, and learnt all sorts of useful information. Now watch him. A man in the room spoke. Can you give me any useful information? I mean something of practical value? I'll ask your brother George. The spirit replied, and then, assuming that character, said, on financial matters I wish to give you a useful hint, Henry. Come here, and I'll whisper it in your ear. He gave him some advice on certain stocks that the man held, and the latter seemed pleased. You'll make a pile of money by that, the spirit added. Is that true? I inquired. Yes, it is, though often we give false advice to ruin our dupes, but sometimes we give genuine information, either so as to lead them on, or else so as to keep them engrossed in earthly matters and so prevent them learning more important spiritual truths. Now watch. The medium approached a young woman. I know what is in your mind, my dear. Yes. Accept him. He will make you a good husband. Don't listen to the lies which are told you about him. What is the object of that advice? I asked. My guide replied, the man who has asked her to marry him is a drunken beast, and a blackguard. He'll drag her down, and then we shall get her. Now see this spirit. He was a jovial hooligan on earth. You'll see some fun. Sure enough, a new control came and began to play all manner of tricks, some harmless, others distinctly malicious, but none quite so devilishly cunning as those of the other spirit. He moved things about and threw them across the room, he hit several persons sharp blows on the head, and hid various objects. He even stole articles out of the sitters' pockets without their knowledge. Nearly all these things were done without any visible contact. Finally, he tipped up the table and upset half the audience. Then we departed. The beauty of these manifestations is, said my guide, that they are the only sort of proof that some materialistic beings will accept of a spirit power. Thus many good mediums and controls have to exhibit them, and so we get our insidious messages accepted by the audience on the strength of them. Above all, they wreck the medium and give us power, and often incidentally bring discredit on these seances generally. We don't like genuine, good mediums and spiritualism generally. They teach and warn too much. Then we went away, but soon returned, and in my next I will show the result. From the above you will doubtless see why I am describing these seances, but there are other reasons. All that is put down here is for a reason, it's all planned out, and if you don't at first see the reason, why, be patient, and you will learn. The officer then spoke. He said, I have been down to the very bottommost depth of hell, impelled largely by that intangible thing, a strong personality. Like a burning fire it drives one on the path one has chosen, and for me there was no hope until that path had been trod. Gone west, the personality made evil by an evil life remains evil after death, and the more probably will it go to the logical conclusion which its evil deeds naturally set up. You say, To know all is to forgive all, and he who has been to the bottom of hell may yet rise to the top, and the knowledge so acquired will be of far more value to himself and the world in general than the lesser knowledge acquired by a feebler soul who did no great evil and very little good. Being asked whether a soul could ever become annihilated by persistent refusal to repent, he said, "It is obvious that a man could not be punished indefinitely for what took place in a finite period. You mean therefore for faults committed after death, which is infinity." Being answered yes, he replied, "What is the soul?" Mr. K. replied, "A part of God." He answered, "Precisely. How, then, can God annihilate even a part of himself? Sooner or later a soul will turn to God, but it may be countless ages before that happens." He then ceased. Gone West, Chapter 6, He Falls from the Astral Plane into Hell, Second Letter from Officer 9:50 p.m., same date, one day, if so I can call it, when we went to one of the seances, I suddenly recognized an old enemy of mine. This man I hated. He had helped to bring about an exposure of my methods. I had learned to control one of these mediums, as described in my last letter. As soon as I saw him, a wild desire to be revenged arose in my mind. There were plenty of spirits at hand to suggest methods. One was that I should get hold of some hooligans and make them murder him, another, to wreck him financially, and so forth. But a far more ingenious method occurred after a while to me. I found that he had begun to dabble in the occult. He did not know much about it, and his motives were by no means exalted, being in the main curiosity. I haunted him day by day and watched his every movement. Whenever an opportunity occurred, I did him an evil turn. If he played cards, I told his opponent what cards he held, and so he lost money. I put in men's minds a vague sense of suspicion and distrust concerning his most innocent acts. But this sort of thing was not the ultimate aim of my attentions. At last my chance came, as I knew it would. He had been endeavoring to get outside his body as he described it. He had no noble aim, and his guide's power had grown weak from various causes, and so when he at length did go out of his body, for about the third time, I came in. "Ha, ha," I chuckled, as once more I found a body clothing me. "This is like old times." But it wasn't. I found that it was only by the exertion of my willpower that I was able to retain control of this borrowed carcass. Anyone with a weaker personality than mine would soon have been compelled to go out again, but I was a far more powerful character than he, and I held it for as long as was necessary. Then I set to work to pay off old scores, and commenced by wrecking his home. I seemed to everyone to be the man himself who all the time was hanging on, still attached by the vital cord to the body, which he nevertheless could not re-enter. I treated his wife so badly that she soon left him in disgust, taking their child with her, and instituted divorce proceedings. I gave rein to all the lusts, such as drink, which could damage his body, and dragged his good name in the gutter by various shady practices. Yet I took care to keep clear of the law. But I had to work quickly and soon completed my task thus. I went to a jeweler's shop, stole a quantity of jewels, murdered the man who owned them, and managed to get caught in my enemy's body. I still held on to that body until it had been formally committed on the charge of murder, and then in the cell I left it. As I did so, I jeered at the waiting spirit who hastened to clothe itself again. When the case came up for trial, I was there, though invisible. The man maintained that he knew nothing of all the facts stated against him, as of course he didn't. Though he knew it as a spirit, he had not been able to register it on his physical brain. His barrister tried the plea of temporary insanity, but, as the judge said in summing up, "Some people argue that all sin is insanity, but we cannot accept that. There is far too much method in this madness. The facts borne out by all the witnesses show that this was only the culminating and logical conclusion of those other detestable acts to which even his wife in her separation suit has borne witness." Then came the usual penalty, death. Now my joy was almost complete, but gradually various things intervened to mar it. He still vowed his innocence, and this though it made no difference to his ultimate fate. Further, his wife, who, in spite of his genuine faults, loved him still, and of course knew, gone west, him well, believed him. When he declared that he had no recollection of all his various misdeeds, she accepted the view that he had been temporarily insane. This had the effect of softening his rebellious spirit, which at first seemed likely to drag him down at the moment of death and make him join us. The prison chaplain also believed him and consoled him, despite all I could do to prevent it. In short, when we gathered at the execution, expecting an angry and revengeful spirit who would be compelled to join us, and over whom I, having a stronger personality, could dominate, we found quite a band of spirits of light, who surrounded him with a guard and kept us at bay and took him away whither we knew not. These events took place in the United States. Suddenly I became aware of the fact that a change was taking place in me. My psychic body seemed to be slipping from me, and, strive as I would, I could not hold it. "Where am I going?" I cried to the evil guide who haunted me. "To hell," he replied. "Don't you think it's time? But you said that by doing these things I should keep nourishing this psychic body?" "For a time," I said, "and so you did. Anyway, you are leaving it now. What is this other body in which I am clothed?" I cried despairingly. "Your spiritual body," he answered, "and in it you will really begin to suffer." And as he spoke I realized how he gloated over me. How I loathed him. But it was so, and was in hell and not yet at the bottom. That, alas, was still to come. But I have written enough tonight. There is a warning in almost every line of this, so do not think these revelations are unnecessary. Study them and think them over. Mr. Rell will now take control to close. Goodbye for the present. The Officer. Gone West, Chapter 7, In Hell. The City of Hate, Rome. Letter from the Officer, March 28, 1913. 9:30. The Officer, when I left off last time, I had told you that I had at length sunk into hell itself. This was different in many ways from the earth plane. I seemed to be falling through space, black, dark, and horrible. At length I reached what appeared to be firm ground, for I discovered a kind of path, and scrambling onto this made my way along it as best I could. Every now and then I slipped off into the horrible filth. All was utter darkness, and the marvel was that I got along at all. I felt drawn in a certain direction by some strange attraction, and ultimately found myself on a desolate, stony plain which appeared to be covered with ashes. Still drawn on through the darkness, I stumbled and struggled on, longing for some human society, be it never so degraded. Then gradually I began to get a sort of half-sight, and by means of it was able dimly to perceive that I was drawing near to some huge mass, which in time grew into the walls and battlements of a great city. Soon I stood before it and saw that it stretched right away as far as I could perceive, though this was not far. There was a gateway, and towards it I turned my steps. No sooner had I come in front of it and noticed that it was built in the manner of a great Roman gateway than what seemed to be doors opened and I passed in. I had hardly done so, when a fiendish yell rang out, and two hideous beings, who apparently acted the part of wardens of the gate, sprang at me. Then I knew that all spirits I should meet here would be enemies, and I turned savagely upon them, prepared to battle for life. I was almost going to say, but of course that sounds absurd. Fight, however, I would, and even as I made up my will to do it, the wretched creatures turned and fled. Thus I learned my first lesson about hell. There is no law here. The strongest oppresses the weakest, and strength lies in the will and in the intellect. I pursued my way unmolested for a time, and found that I could now distinguish the various buildings as through a dense fog. Gradually the idea grew upon me that I recognized this city. It was ancient Rome. Yes, but far more than that. For to it had been added all the buildings which had been built there since the days of the Caesars, and in time I learned the truth. This was the spirit city of Rome, and many other cities, built of the buildings in which had been committed all the deeds of cruelty and hate. All the evil emanations which had been thrown off by its former inhabitants had gone to build up this imperial city of hell. Its better emanations had gone elsewhere, to the realms above. And this is the fate of every city or building on earth. Its evil side is dragged down to hell, just as its pure form goes to the realms of half-belief or of full belief. Here I found was not only Rome, but Venice and Milan, and 1,000 other cities in which hate and cruelty had reigned. This vast city is not the only city in hell. There are countless others. To each of these cities of hate the damned are drawn, according as the natural laws of attraction act, some to one, some to another. Besides cities of hate, there are many others, such as the cities of lust. Paris and London may be found there. London, or parts of it, may be found in many of these cities, each part differing, for London at different times has had many different forms. Through the dirty, foul, and yet splendid streets I wended my way. Often I met men and women, many of them clad apparently in the kind of clothes they wore on earth. But these robes were foul and torn. Some of them rushed at me to attack me, but each one I was able to repel by means of my willpower. Then an idea came to me. Why should I not, gone west, attack one of them, make him my slave, and compel him to tell me about this new city in which I had to dwell? Acting on this, I sprang at a man, who turned with a shriek and fled. But I willed that he should come to me, and slowly he crawled back, struggling all the while. When I had him, I made him grovel in anguish, just to show him I was master, then bade him rise and show me the sights of the place. Whining, he did so, and led me to various buildings. Would you like to see a gladiatorial show? He inquired. Yes, I cried. Soon we were in what seemed like the Colosseum, and I saw that the place was full. Seizing a man, I hurled him out. There was a foul-looking woman seated next, and I threw her out also. We two then sat down. The show had just begun, and I saw that opposite us was a great royal box. Yonder is the emperor, whispered my slave in an awestruck voice. Which? I inquired. I don't know, but he is the emperor, and he rules this part of the city. Are there several emperors here? I inquired. Yes, many, and kings and generals too. Don't they quarrel? Quarrel? Where have you come from, stranger? We all quarrel here. This is the city of hate and cruelty. We are constantly fighting against each other, district against district, emperor against emperor. We have just conquered a district near here, and therefore the emperor is celebrating his victory by making the prisoners fight with the gladiators. Here they come. Then began the most ghastly show I have ever witnessed. All the horrors of an ancient gladiatorial show without one redeeming feature were enacted before our eyes. There was no noble martyrdom to relieve the beastliness of the whole show. It was not merely men against men, but men against women, and even against children. Tortures of every description were inflicted, and the wretched victims shrieked and screamed. It was just as if the scene was on earth, save that no death came to release the victims. On and on it went. Now, as I write it and you read it, the effect is to produce a sense of pity and nausea. But at that time the effect was the reverse. It pandered to my worst side and roused a fierce lust of cruelty and hate, and so it did in others. This was the object of the emperor. Now farewell. I will write more another day. The officer. Gone West 100, Chapter VLLI, The Emperor. A Theater in Hell, Trance Conversation with the Office of the Presence of H. J. L. March 30th, the newcomer's face was as I described it when I saw him clairvoyantly. It was a strong face, but not a pleasant one. Nevertheless, I thought it looked much less marked with evil than it had done when last I saw him. I greeted him in a friendly spirit, and he at once took up the thread of his narrative where he had dropped it in his last letter. The officer. At length the show was over, and as we dispersed my slave and I took up our positions near a gateway to watch the egress of the emperor. Soon a wild throng appeared around the emperor's chariot. I noticed many spirits, both male and female, quite naked. I said to my slave, "This is the first time I have seen naked spirits. We always seem to clothe ourselves by instinct." __, he replied, "These are compelled to assume this shape by the emperor to amuse his evil passions." The officer. It is not possible for them, though, to have relations one with the other, is it? Slave. Surely, master, you must know by now that, having no physical bodies, we cannot enjoy any physical pleasures. We can pretend to do these things, but it is all a hollow sham, a vain pretense. Our passions burn as fiercely as ever, but we have no bodies with which to gratify them. What are the animals in hell? I cried, as several great hunting dogs dashed past us. He replied, "No, these are the spirits of men and women whom the emperor compels to assume this shape, just as the others are compelled to appear naked or as children. He is so powerful that he can compel us to assume any shape he chooses, even that of his furniture. The latter is a favorite amusement of his." The procession passed amid scenes of the wildest debauchery and cruelty. A long shriek of anguish rose as it slowly passed along. Various forms of torture were being inflicted, sometimes on the members of the imperial cortege, and sometimes on the spectators who lined the route. In particular, I noticed that the dogs were repeatedly set to worry some of the women and the men in the procession, or to drag spectators before the emperor. When he rode in this chariot, the picture of cruelty and pride. His face was so lined by evil that it was almost impossible to realize what his original features had been like. I should think, however, that in his youth on earth he had been a handsome man. But evil had almost obliterated this. "Who is he?" I inquired. "Is he Nero?" My slave replied, "No, master. I have forgotten who he was, but I do know he is not Nero. Nero is a slave to this man. Nero is a very feeble being compared with the emperor, and though he has several times tried to raise rebellion against the emperor, the latter has always crushed him sooner or later. Still, Nero is very cunning, and often escapes from the vigilance of those who have to guard him. Each time he is caught, the emperor inflicts the most excruciating torments upon him. Indeed, torturing Nero is one of the emperor's favorite amusements." "But surely you must know who the emperor was when alive?" I inquired. "I've forgotten, if I ever knew."
"You liar, you don't forget. Tell me at once."
"Gone west 101, as I could get nothing out of him, I began to imagine the most horrible torments I could devise, and by willing that he should suffer them, caused him to writhe in anguish. As, however, he evidently did not know the name, I at last grew tired of this amusement and bade him rise and show me something else to entertain me. "I will take you to a theater," he answered. "What sort of performance do you have here?"
"Oh, extremely clever and exciting. They deal with all the famous cases of hate and cruelty which have occurred on Earth, and if possible our managers try to get the original persons to reenact the same scenes here as on Earth."
"Don't you have anything dealing with lust or drink?" "They come in as subsidiary parts of the plot, but this is the city of hate and cruelty, and, therefore, that is the dominant inspiration of all our plays here. In the cities of lust it is, of course, lust that dominates. Still, as the latter often produces cruelty, we see a fair number of representations of it and of other pleasant vices."
"Are any fresh plays composed here?"
"Not many, and those are but a reshuffling of the ideas which have been enacted on Earth. However, there are plenty of real dramas of cruelty being enacted on Earth every day, so we are never at a loss for a new play."
"Nothing original ever comes out of hell, I suppose?" I inquired.
"Nothing, so far as I know, but plenty of perversions and parodies from elsewhere." We now stood before the doors of a great theater. We had walked some distance, and here the buildings seemed fairly modern. The theatre certainly was quite modern, but it looked dirty and neglected. The latter was, however, certainly not the case. On the contrary, people were hurrying through the doors in considerable numbers. We went with the crowd, and, once through the door, our ears were assailed by a fearful noise, due to the fact that almost everyone was quarreling with his next-door neighbor, either alleging that he had pushed him or that he had tried to rob him, or for some other pretended reason. At the booking office, a constant wrangle seemed to be in process between the booking clerk and each person who came demanding a seat. Annoyed by the continual row, I called up all my willpower and, despite the angry protests of the crowd, forced my way through to the booking office, dragging my slave with me. The latter, safe under my protection, did his best to hurt several of those we passed, and succeeded in catching a woman by the hair and throwing her on the ground, where the crowd ruthlessly trampled her underfoot. We made for the stalls,
and on entering the theater proper I perceived that nearly half the audience was engaged in quarreling and fighting. Close by us in the stalls a man and woman were fighting.